McMillan and then Strobel. So McMillan first?
Yes.
All in favor then of Trustee McMillan?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
What's that?
Mr. Oliver votes aye.
Mr. Oliver votes aye. And did you get that count?
No, I did not. Did you like to show of hands?
You did such a good job that first time. And I like the way it turned out.
Mr. Chairman, you might ask for any nays. If there are no, it'll be obvious that if you might ask for any nays.
Okay. Are there any nay votes?
There you have it.
Okay. And then Trustee McMillan?
Yes, it's done.
Excuse me.
That's done.
Should we try it a third time? Or Trustee Carroll?
Yes, thank you.
All those in favor?
All those in
aye.
Favor? Any nays?
Nay.
It appears that there are at least two nay votes. The rest of them were ayes, so a majority have.
And then Trustee Strobel?
Carroll. Aye.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Are there any nays?
I vote against myself, but I did vote for
her. That's nice. So how did we end up?
I'm voting for her.
I thought that was what you wanted, so I'm siding with you even though I'm voting against you.
Michelle, would you summarize the result, please?
We have, I heard one nay.
No, I mean the total vote, the result in terms of the executive committee election.
I think we might have to have a show of hands because I did hear one nay, so, and for only one candidate, for one nominee. So
I'll simplify that. I'll withdraw my name.
Beautiful. The result
I think that was your wish. So,
Mr. McMillan and Ms. Strobel are elected.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
There's some brief confusion there. Trustees Ed McMillan and Patricia Strobel have been nominated and elected as members of the three-person executive committee. The third person would be the new chair of the trustees, Christopher
Kennedy. Delegation
of
signatures?
Yes, that's right.
And,
what do we need to do now, Michelle?
I will enter the language into the record, sir, with leave of the board, if that is agreeable. And you need just one motion to approve the resolutions for delegation of signatures.
Okay. So I think we're authorizing signatures for our bank accounts and a series of other things.
Exactly.
If somebody would move it.
I so move, Mr. Chairman.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Very good.
Thank you. And then we'll turn it back over to President White.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the Executive Committee and the Board. We'd like to turn now to a session on university governance. Before we do
and at this point, we will leave the live coverage of the University of Illinois Board of Trustees. They were expected also today, at least during the session sometime today or this afternoon. There was talk that they may have been doing it as early as this morning, passing a resolution that would change some of the features of the University of Illinois admission system, among them disallowing any so-called clout list or the category I list, as it was called among administrators, that considered students based on political endorsements or endorsements from political leaders or other trustees. That system will be discontinued and disallowed under the resolution that the trustees were to vote on, as well as a move to make the process more transparent, to make an appeal system more transparent, and also make the admission system a little more obvious to the to people who enter that system. One concern was that there was no knowledge of an appeals process in the current admission system, although there was one in place. They'll try to make that a lot more transparent, and they'll also create a firewall between admissions officials and University of Illinois administrators, trustees, or other political officials again, to help eliminate the use of political clout in getting students in, some who may have had substandard academic records. That may be voted on later today, but as you heard, very brief comments from Governor Pat Quinn, who was late in attending the meeting, and then the election of Christopher Kennedy as the new chair of the U of I Board of Trustees. They are now in place and in office and conducting regular university business. You'll be able to see the rest of the meeting live on our website. There is a video link to the Board of Trustees live streaming meeting, and you can see what's going on there. Go to our website at will.illinois.edu, and there on the homepage you'll be able to see a link to a live coverage of the meeting again. For our purposes, though, we will return to Focus 580, which we will join now in progress.
I was handed a class on food, and I wasn't a food scholar. And so at UC Davis, we have renowned programs in nutrition science, viticulture and enology, and food science and technology. So I think there was a desire on the part of a lot of the programs to find a way to connect to those sciences, and that food was a way that we could study everyday phenomenon, things like consumption and production and the relationship that we have as humans to the natural world, but that we could do that in a way that would allow students a point of entry so that they right away understand what we're talking about. These aren't abstract concepts. Mm-hmm. And it allows you to discuss a lot of really important cultural concepts, but from a place where students right away have an opinion and they think that they know something. So you can unpack what they know and begin to show them this complex web that brings things from the point of growing to industrial development, to the marketing messages that we have, to our ideas about nutrition and what appropriate bodies should be. So it's a wonderful subject to teach. And I think that that's why it's also expanding as a curriculum, as a component of the curriculum on a lot of campuses across the country. There's even an organization, the Association for the Study of Food, that bring scholars together every year to talk about the work that they're doing on food. And most of them are not food scholars. It's not really a field, right? We're historians, sociologists, anthropologists, but who find that by discussing food, we have this common point where we can begin to argue about our different perspectives and also really engage issues that matter right now to Americans. I mean, all you have to do is pick up whatever Michael Pollan's latest book is, and you realize we're really obsessed with thinking about food and with trying to be more ethical somehow through our decisions about food and acquiring knowledge about food. So that's where I started for this project.
Yeah. I think it's really very, very interesting that you can use food as a way of studying the way people think about so many other things, how people feel about their bodies and what's good, how people feel about the environment and how they connect to it, how people feel about consumer culture, and the current thing that we have about functional foods. We have this idea that foods can be viewed as medicine. They're not just something that we eat because it keeps us alive, but there are these other benefits that may or may not attach. It's a wonderfully complex subject that goes way beyond even nutrition, which is complicated enough.
Right. And if you think about whatever your last moment was in the grocery store, right, as you're staring at this proliferation of options and, you know, reading the labels and looking at the marketing messages and thinking about where does this come from and how do you make a good choice about food? It's a really fascinating question right now. So with this project, I wanted to start with something that is sort of my generation. I grew up in a house where, you know, we had I Can't Believe It's Not Butter and egg beaters and Crystal Light. NutraSweet was just, you know, common. It was the common sweetener in my house. And I was fascinated by, you know, how did all that stuff get there? And how did we come to accept that as normal and good? And is there a way that we can kind of think backwards and make some generalizations about what it means when we choose a particular food product over others. And in this case, choosing an artificial sweetener over sugar. It would have been impossible to believe for someone in the 19th century that you would have had people who could make the choice opting not to have sugar, which was widely considered an important food for health, and instead having a chemical that offers sweetness with very few or no productive calories. So that shift really about a 50-year period of time is a phenomenal cultural change, especially when one considers the importance of sugar sweetness right back through the 17th century and the slave trade and the rise of productive labor in the working class in England, certainly the economic development in the colonies. So moving to where people want to have a no-calorie sweet from a sort of rich, caloric, natural, although natural is a complicated word, sweet, means there's something that went on. And I thought there was a good story to tell.
Yeah. Well, let me introduce again our guest. We're now on live, so that means that people can join in the conversation if they would like. We're talking this morning with Carolyn De La Pena. She is Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of California, Davis, where she also directs the Davis Humanities Institute. And she is interested in a lot of different things that have to do with food and its cultural significance. She is now working on a project that will end up as a book that's scheduled to be out sometime next year. The title, Empty Pleasures, An Unnatural History of Artificial Sweetener. That's going to be published by the University of North Carolina Press, which is all about the production, consumption of things like saccharin and aspartame and sucralose in the United States. She's here visiting the campus to give a talk in the MillerCom series. And she'll be giving her talk on this very subject about artificial sweeteners this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. And as I said, this is a part of a CAS, Center for Advanced Study, initiative. And these programs, they are always open to the public. So anybody who would like to attend should certainly feel welcome. Anyone can attend. So that's this afternoon at 4. And here on the program, questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I don't want to put you in the position of giving your whole talk, but not everyone listening to us would be able to attend. So I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the history of sweeteners for, and it's my understanding that this work, the scientific work, was done, say, beginning about in the mid-1940s, so maybe just like right after World War II. What was it that led the scientists who did this work to do that? Why were they interested in developing an artificial sweetener?
So artificial sweetener was actually first invented in the 1870s. That was saccharin, and it was invented at Johns Hopkins. But it didn't appear in the U.S. food supply, I should say, in a way that consumers wanted it to until the 1940s and 1950s. So what happened was the first time it showed up, it was actually one of the first three products produced by Monsanto Chemical when it originated in 1903. And what it did was it provided carbonated beverage manufacturers a way to have a cheap substitute for sugar. Sugar was a fairly volatile commodity. It was always subject to tariffs. There was an effort to protect the U.S. sugar trade against foreign imports. So a lot of carbonated beverage manufacturers found that they could never really judge what the price would be of sugar. And it was attractive to them when this new substance was discovered quite by accident. In fact, each of the artificial sweeteners that have been discovered, whether it's saccharin or cyclamates or aspartame, better known as NutraSweet, or sucralose, which we call Splenda, these were all sort of industrial accidents. You know, the way the chemist licks his finger, believe it or not, there are stories after stories. Someone picking up a cigarette in the lab and licking the cigarette and realizing that it tastes sweet, and suddenly instead of a liver extract, you have a new product and you're looking for a purpose for it, a place for it to go. So when consumers first found out that saccharin was in their food supply, in canned goods and in sodas, they were really upset. And that was part of the whole progressive movement around the first pure food and drug laws. Saccharin was one of the things that was eliminated from the food supply, but it wasn't made illegal because diabetics still needed a sugar substitute. So what you have is during World War II, when there were rations for sugar, you have women beginning to experiment with alternative sweeteners in canning and in home cooking. And so like molasses and honey, saccharin became one of those experimental tools where you have women who would actually go into the drugstore and pick up a very medicinal-looking bottle with pills in it and experiment with using those pills in the home. So the question of why did artificial sweetener then enter foods when food manufacturers just 50 years earlier, you know, were giving all kinds of warnings to each other, don't use it. No matter how cheap it is, you'll pay the price with consumers when they figure it out. How do you get from that point to where food manufacturers are actually promoting artificial sweetener and talking about it being healthy and more healthy than sugar? And so what I'm going to talk about today are sort of two answers to that, because I'm really interested in this period between the early 1950s and the mid-1970s when we have things like Diet Right and TAB that, you know, make it ubiquitous, is the relationship between pharmaceutical companies and fruit canners, which actually before diet soda we had diet fruit in the U.S. So what is it about the relationship there that made that an attractive collaboration? And on the other hand, the first women entrepreneurs who entered the business, some of them were canners themselves, some of them were food writers in women's dailies, and some of them were, like Jean Nidich, the founder of Weight Watchers, women who realized that they could set up entire diet plans where they could put pleasure as part of restraint and diet that was really attractive in the 1960s especially.
Yeah. Well, this I think this that's a very interesting point, and I wonder when it was that, and perhaps this took some time, but when it was that the people who developed the products simply as an alternative to sugar got the idea that this was something that could be promoted in a way that says you can have your sweets, but you can still be thin or you can still lose weight. So it was a two-for-one kind of a deal.
Right. Absolutely. When you look at fruit canners, and this is what I've done a lot of work on, there during World War II, a lot of the canners didn't have access to sugar the same way that, you know, consumers didn't. So they experimented with packing fruits without sugar, and they found that there was actually a demand. And you know, you can chart the rise in the vogue of thinness from about the 1930s on, but it certainly reached a peak, at least really among white women in particular in the 1950s. But these fruit manufacturers realized a couple of things. One, that there was a market, and it was interesting because they were small fruit canners. The one that I look at is in California. Not Dole, not Del Monte, the big ones, but the smaller ones, who saw that they had an opportunity to distinguish themselves from the rest of the market. And also the guys who were involved who had been kind of canning chemists, which was a fairly old school sort of technology, they were really interested in learning from the pharmaceutical companies. So there was a courtship between the pharmaceutical companies, and it was Abbott Laboratories that first developed the cyclamates, that where pharmaceutical companies worked with these canning companies in order to tell them, you know, there's going to be a market. And in fact, we're preparing a market. They were selling it to consumers at home. They were beginning to advertise cyclamates as a way to lose weight. And they had the fruit canners that kind of came in and developed this line of diet products, while the pharmaceutical companies provided the research that fruit canners couldn't have afforded to do on their own. And they also provided the prestige. You know, you can't – this is one of the things that really fascinates me is we think about diet foods as, you know, mostly a women's product, right? I mean, that it's mostly women that diet. And, of course, there are plenty of men that diet as well. But we think about it as a consumer issue. When did people decide they wanted to lose weight? And so then we got diet products. But, in fact, when you look at the history of it, it was as much a story about the men who worked in these industries and how they wanted to collaborate with each other and expand market share as it was about consumer demand. Because, obviously, consumers could have decided to drink water. I mean, there are plenty of ways. It's very true that people wanted to be thin in the 50s, and there was a lot of fear about, you know, excess commodities. Because if you think about it, food became cheap. After World War II, you know, consumption was the way that we needed to rebuild the nation. That was the rhetoric. So it made sense. You also bought a lot of food and consumed a lot of food. What do you do with all those extra calories? There were lots of answers to that, you know, including exercise and plenty of the things we think about today. In fact, exercise wasn't widely touted as a way to lose weight until the late 1970s. food products were a way to lose weight. The very food products that proliferated, that created much of the problem of excess weight, were seen then as a way to solve the problem. It was actually quite a brilliant industry turn. And those things really hanged on how canners saw that canning was going to be a lost art with the rise of frozen foods and the quick importation of fresh produce. They needed a way to preserve space in the market. And being the first at diet was a really important way to do it. Mm. And then you have a whole decade of women entrepreneurs coming in to create the messaging around those products, right? And what we don't really think much about today is that when we look at how the relationship between pharmaceuticals and food, nutraceuticals and these kinds of, many of them are very useful tools to enhance health. But the first way that pharmaceutical companies really came into the food supply was through diet foods. An industrial chemical with no use, cyclamate or saccharin, finds a fabulous use by wetting itself with sodas and canned fruits and now puddings and jellos and ice creams and And it's a wonderful whole second line of product. You actually double the total amount of product sold.
Yeah, and I think it's very interesting that that the two parts of this, the production of the chemicals and getting them into the product, and then the marketing of the product is gendered in the way that it is. That, and maybe it's not surprising that the scientists and the guys who are running the canning companies were men, but that the people that ended up selling the product, marketing the product, were women. And again, maybe that's not surprising because it sounds as if mostly they were selling to other women.
Mm-hmm. Right. They were selling to other women. But it's also important to see that there was a real sense of mission in this. You know, it's easy to see kind of there must have been some consumer manipulation and people just wanting to make money around it, which certainly was a factor. But when you really look at these histories of the entrepreneurs, you see that the canners took quite seriously the problem of obesity. You know, that this was even as early as the mid-1950s. Pharmaceutical companies are providing lots of data to canners about the problem of rising weight and that this is going to be a problem for the nation, you know, so that canners could kind of come in and be part of that line of defense with the diet products. And for the women who were involved, there was a real tradition in among food writers and women's magazine writers of bringing sort of modern news to the masses, right? Bringing the news first, whether it was appliances and convenience, new techniques for the home, things around childcare, that diet products were also a way that women really wanted to understand these new chemical marvels. You know, and that this was a way that women could, in fact, change the diets of their families. They didn't have to tell their husbands. They could sneak this into the food. Who would know if you brought dessert to the table and used those canned peaches instead of those canned peaches, right? Mm-hmm. So there was this sense that you can almost kind of feel consumers really not understanding how to deal with the sheer mass of product that was out there and the rising appetite. You know, this over and over you hear these women who were developing diet plans with artificial sweetener actually using words like torture. It would be torture to go without, you know, that willpower, it's impossible to have willpower. And certainly they were, you know, spicing it up so that they could create a problem that they could solve with their product. But they were also tapping into something really very real, which I find very compelling sitting here at this moment as we look at consumer appetite. You know, and the question of sustainability and the credit crisis and just how did we get to a point where we want so much more than we can handle, and that there's a parallel in our food appetites as well. You know, we have to learn to eat at a certain level. And when artificial sweeteners appear on the scene, you have a way that you can actually be healthy if we define health as weight. You can be healthy and consume an immense amount of commodity. Right. And so these people really saw themselves as kind of brokers of that new modern kind of bridge between the body that can only consume X number of calories a day and the amount of industrial product that has to move through a consumer system to be healthy. How does the body be healthy and the food industry be healthy at the same time?
Yeah. It also seems to me to reflect something that it's particularly, I think of as a particularly post-war attitude, but maybe it was there in other times of America. And that is, and it doesn't just connect with the way people think about food, and that is the idea that you can have everything. You can have everything that you want. You can indulge yourself as much as you want, and that it's still going to be okay. So if your goals are, you know, you want to have something sweet, you want to eat as much stuff as you want for the pleasure that's associated with it, but you don't want to gain a lot of weight, here we have a way that you can have both of those things. And it seems like it's a reflection of our desire to want to have the cake and eat it too. And we do that with a lot of things and not just with food.
Yeah, you're quoting actually Bob Shapiro, who was one of the heads along with Donald Rumsfeld at Cyril when NutraSweet was approved for mass consumption in the early 1980s, who actually said that you can have, you know, now NutraSweet shows you can have your cake and eat it too. It's that promise, and we finally delivered on that promise. And and that promise is at the base of these diet plans that have a tremendous amount of value to people. I mean, and I don't mean to question that, certainly. But when you look at Jenny Craig and Weight Watchers, these are plans that were basically based on this core argument that you should be able to have pleasure and you should be able to exercise restraint, and that those have to go together. Jean Neidich, in her 1970 first book on it's her biography, but also a guide to Weight Watchers, talked about how her initial idea about how people needed to reorder their relationship to food was you should keep a picture of your fat self on the refrigerator. And every morning you should get dressed in your biggest outfit that you once had. You should always remind yourself of the fatness that could be there, right? So it's built in that you're never really over it, or you never really lose that appetite. It's sort of part of you, and you have to remind yourself about it. But her advice initially was to keep a can of asparagus in your glove compartment with a can opener. I am not making this up. And that when you were overwhelmed with a food craving, even if you were in the car driving somewhere, you would just pull over and you would open up that can of asparagus and you would eat it. And she used the words, you know, food is fuel, and you have to change your attitude towards food. If you want to eat something, eat a head of cabbage, eat a pile of mushrooms, eat asparagus. But once she developed, along, you know, with the company that grew and went national and international, an entire line of foods and a food plan, in order to reach more people, she changed that message to, you know, we all crave chocolate. We all crave good things. We all want sweets. So use legal sweets. Legal, her own word. Mm-hmm. These ones, sweetened with artificial sweeteners. She, in fact, and Weight Watchers began to kind of encourage the craving of food and to sort of tell you it was fully normal and natural not to be able to do without sweets. But instead, you just take that craving, not to your can of asparagus. You take it over here to Weight Watchers chocolate sodas and Weight Watchers puddings, and so that the sweetness was built into the very system that was supposed to help you reduce. And it wasn't a matter just of, you know, Weight Watchers making this up. That's a whole cultural movement. I mean, you could do a mini analysis of Reaganomics around that same promise that, you know, there's a ton of supply, right? And that these things in this kind of new day, you shouldn't deny yourself. You should have it. We should be able to have everything we want, and we look to science and technology and innovation to enable us to do that. We don't want less, and we don't question the impact of our desires. We just change the stuff so we can have it, because the stuff is the problem. It's not
us. Yeah,
right.
Our guest. Let me just very quickly reintroduce our guest, and then we have a caller. Carolyn de la Peña is Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of California, Davis, where she also directs the Davis Humanities Institute. In her work, she's interested in popular technology and science, in material and business cultures, in gender, and in food. She's now working on Empty Pleasures, an Unnatural History of Artificial Sweetener. That's a book that will come out next year from the University of North Carolina Press, which is a cultural history of the production and consumption of artificial sweeteners. And she's here visiting the campus and will be giving a talk that's based on that work, talking about saccharin, gender, and power in the making and marketing of artificial sweetener. This is a part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative, and the talk will be this afternoon at 4 on the U of I campus at the Knight Auditorium. It's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. And these events, like all of the events that they do at the Center for Advanced Study, like the Millercom series, they're all free and open to the public, so anybody who would like to attend should feel welcome. Questions, too, are welcome if you'd like to join the conversation. The only thing we ask of people is just that they're brief so we can keep moving and hope people will be on the topic. But otherwise, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign County. Line 1. Hello.
Yeah, I hope I don't digress. I'm just struck by the irony that it was, you know, sweetened fruit that was the sort of the entree to this, because in a sort of a cottage industry or something, I think you need sugar to can fruit safely, but at other levels one wouldn't need that much fruit, if sugar, if any at all. And you know, it's like sweetened fruit, I mean, I know it's part of the preservative process, but it just seems to me that's kind of an irony that was the entree to. And that it wasn't done by Dole and larger corporations, too, is a little surprising to me. Because perhaps this is a digression, but I wonder whether you know about this apocryphal, whether the story is apocryphal or not, that when Donald Rumsfeld was in charge of the corporation that was marketing aspartame, he actually confessed that they knew that they hadn't done any longitudinal studies that were sufficient to show whether it was really safe or not in the long run, and how it would affect. But he sort of blithely said that, we don't have to worry about that because nobody's going to track it down to us. And I don't know if you know that story.
Yeah. I want to respond to both of those things.
I actually have another point about xylitol, and then I think I'll hang up and listen. Because I've actually started using it in sort of a handcrafted ginger ale, because I've got addicted to ginger ale, and as sort of in the curative mode, but you know, it's the kind you get now. Even Schweppes is corn syrup, right? So I craft this bitters and carbonated water and xylitol together for my nighttime. And I don't know. I kind of feel rather odd about it. It's not inexpensive, but it's supposed to be good for your teeth too, which would be absolutely great for something that you're perhaps swigging in the middle of the night when you don't have a chance to, like Schweppes would linger. And anyway, that's probably a major digression, but I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
I think I can comment on those things and do it fairly quickly. The great points. The sweet, you know, why fruit is an interesting one. Canned fruit relative to how we would think about it today doesn't seem like that would provide a tremendous amount of sugar calories, but because canned fruit was so important and it was really the main source of where fruit came from, there were a couple liabilities to sugar. It's not so much that there was a ton of it, it's that you had it so frequently, and it's also that it pointed out what wasn't fresh about it, that the sugar in the fruit was sort of an excess sugar that you took in. And so those were reasons why people saw fruit and canned fruit as a good thing not to have sugar or to have diet fruits to begin with. I should clarify that Dole and Del Monte did develop lines of diet fruit, but they weren't there first. It was the smaller canners who were willing to take the risk. And it was a sufficient risk. And this is something I also wanted to mention. You know, it matters that it was fruit, because cyclamates had a very uncertain future. In fact, they were made illegal in 1969, as many people know. It was always uncertain what the FDA would do with cyclamates. They had a generally recognized as safe or grass label, which allowed cyclamates to be used in non-diabetic products. But the way they got that was by bringing in the fruit canners. So literally, these small canners were brought to D.C., where they met with members of the FDA and the committees determining the safety of cyclamates, and talked about how they were using them, the kind of restrictions that they had, the safety in the plants, and also brought their label. I mean, this was one of the companies I look at, Richmond Chase, very old family farms, you know, with labels that had peaches on them and pictures of nature. And it mattered that Abbott Laboratories was able to bring in those fruit canners, because it was one of the ways that they got the security and the approval from the FDA to use cyclamates in canned products that were meant for the masses, that weren't labeled as diabetic or dietetic, which is how things would have been before. So the fruits were really an important entry point for the pharmaceutical industry as well. And I should also say that many of those canners ended up having quite a liability on their hands in 69 when the FDA did come back and say that because of the Delaney Clause, which says any amount of possible carcinogen in the food supply is prohibited, that cyclamates would not be available anymore for public consumption. Richmond Chase, which was the first canner there to buy Abbott's product and to can up their fruit, had done a whole year's worth of pack, and they lost 3 million cans of fruit, and they eventually went bankrupt in the 1980s, no small part because of this. So the other piece of this that I wanted to say is the NutraSweet piece, and all you have to do is Google aspartame or NutraSweet, and you can see all the controversies, that there's a ton of folklore about what NutraSweet does to you, that it's quite bad for you. And in fact, if you have a rare genetic condition, it can be very, very bad for you, but very few people do. But many more people believe that NutraSweet impacts them negatively. I think a lot of this comes from the uncertainty about, you know, what these chemicals really do. And NutraSweet does have a little bit of a shady pass to it, although there aren't any conclusive studies that show that it's a health hazard, even after all this time. But still, you know, when Rumsfeld came in, who'd been the Secretary of Defense, and he was the CEO of NutraSweet, you had a very quick changing of the guard under Reagan as the FDA commissioner. The first thing the new commissioner did in 1983, well, one of the first, was to say there's been plenty of testing on aspartame, and it is safe for public consumption. There were many people in the FDA who felt the longitudinal studies, in fact, were not done and that needed to be done. So there was a little bit of that that occurred initially that I think made many people distrust aspartame. And that has grown into quite an extravagant folklore over the years, especially if you want to point fingers at industrial food. Aspartame is a place where many people have gone to do that. And the last thing I'll say about your comment on experimenting at home with sweeteners is I think a lot of people are doing this now. The popularity of stevia really, to me, shows that you know, we still want and need artificial or no-calorie sweets for many reasons, but a lot of people are uncomfortable using the ones provided on the mass market, or uncomfortable using chemicals, however we want to define what that is. Mm-hmm. So the popularity of stevia, a lot of people talk to me about stevia when I talk about my work. Is stevia okay? Is stevia good? And I think the desire to find now in a root, in something that really comes from nature, again, like the great sweet, the have your cake and eat it too sweet, is really part of where we're at culturally. I often respond with, well, you know, are you a diabetic? You know, can you have sugar? Well, yeah, they can have sugar. Well, that's not an option, or that, and even it would be a big digression, but our attitudes towards sugar are also framed by the artificial sweetener industry. The very research that shows that artificial sweetener is bad is often financed by the sugar industry, and the research that shows that sugar is bad is financed by the artificial sweetener industries. So right, we're at a state of real sweet confusion.
Yeah. Right, well, now. And also I think it's really interesting that also now, because people have a variety of concerns about corn sweetener, that now I'm noticing that there are products that are saying we've gone back to using sugar, and that they're using that as a marketing point. They're even putting it on the package as if that there are people who say, well, hooray for that. I understand the concerns about how much of our food supply, one way or another, is all about corn. But I guess my question is, well, why is that? Why do you think that is better? And in fact, is that better? Does it truly make much difference, either to your body or to the environment?
Right. One of the reasons why corn syrup is so vilified right now, I think, is that we haven't thought about corn syrup for a long time. We've been thinking about sugar or artificial sweetener because those are the industries that have set the tone, either by attacking one another, while corn syrup has made its way into our food and, of course, into our packaged foods. And one of the things about corn syrup is you often don't know that it's there because, you know, it's in your cracker. It's not where you think that you're looking for sugar. But again, I think Is corn syrup bad? Is sugar bad? Is artificial sweetener bad? There's two answers that I would give to that. You know, in a 24 can case, probably, you know, most things might not be that good. I mean, maybe it's about the total amount of anything that you're consuming and looking for the one that's good it through some sort of statement about whether it is inherently a good thing or a bad thing is useful. But we also might want to look at ourselves and ask, well, how often am I having this and how often should I? What would make me feel good about it? And what does that mean? How does where I get my sweet pleasure relate to other ways that I interact with materials and consumption in the world? But then I also come back to this question of the calorie. You know, I really, after doing all this research, I feel like the calorie has a use. When sweetness is connected to calories, there's something that your body gets in the exchange. You get the capacity for labor. You get that sweetness comes in and labor goes out, mm-hmm. right? And so that, to me, gives sugar and corn syrup a value that artificial sweeteners don't have, which is that we then can go do work. The thing is, though, we have to be able to put the sweetness down and go do the work. I mean, there has to be a point where you're not taking in the sweetness. And I think it's nearly impossible for an American consumer who absorbs media messages to have a sense of what an appropriate sweet appetite is. These days, the food industry has put, you know, incalculable dollars into making this a difficult decision for us, and yet we still do kind of feel like it's our decision we have to make on our own. You know,
our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Carolyn de la Peña. She is associate professor of American Studies at University of California, Davis. Among other things, she's interested in food and in popular technology and science. She's the author of a book that's scheduled to come out next year that deals with this subject that we've been talking about. The title, Empty Pleasures, An Unnatural History of Artificial Sweetener, will be published by the University of North Carolina Press, and she is on the campus to give a talk. This is part of an initiative of the Center for Advanced Study. It's also sponsored by a number of other units on the campus, part of their initiative, Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. And she'll be giving a talk on the campus this afternoon. We have about 10 minutes, a little bit more, in this hour focus, and we do have some other calls, so we'll try to get them both. Starting next with someone in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Well, at last, I don't know if you've covered this or not. I haven't been able to listen all the way through. There's a phenomenon that's been going on in our culture for a while that I find really annoying. And, you know, anymore it's almost impossible as an example to have a successful dinner party due to the fact that so many people in our society view food as medicine. You know, it's almost like trying to feed a bunch of five-year-olds. Oh, I'll eat that, but I won't eat that. And I'll eat this kind of meat, but I won't eat that kind of meat. And so on and so forth. Did you comment at all or look into at all this phenomenon that many people in our culture don't eat anymore for the pleasure of eating and don't think to themselves, you know, if I have a nice rare hunk of prime rib every other month, it's probably not going to harm me any, rather than being radical and saying, oh, I'm not going to, you know, no beef at all, et cetera, comment on it any way you would, please. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, in this way, artificial sweetener is really connected to a much bigger web of food information. And so the one thing I would say about this is if you want to blame someone or an era for this issue, it's probably out of the 1970s and late 1970s and early 1980s when nutritional information was when we began to say that not, you know, you should eat less meat, or you should have, you know, have this, but don't have it as often. Instead, we begin to pick out pieces of things. You know, cholesterol is bad. Don't have that. Omega-3s are this. Do or don't have that. Sugar, fat, you know, high. This, that we broke down ingredients in things and taught consumers that what they needed to do to be healthy was to regulate themselves. And so we provided a mandate for people to begin to think, you know, well, what do I eat and don't I eat? And to be healthy, I won't have that. So many of us focus on a particular thing we will or we won't eat. But I don't think we just get that out of the ether. I think that's because nutritional information tends to come down focused on one particular thing at a particular moment, and much of that depends on whoever's food lobby is the weakest in that area. You know, it's quite difficult to provide the kinds of information to people about, you know, take pleasure in food, have small portions. You know, these are the kinds of things we're beginning to hear much more now. But it takes many, many years for dietary advice to shift and the way that people think about it to shift. And I think when people are overwhelmed by the sheer difficulty of making good food choices because there's so much conflicting information, many of us kind of hold on to one thing we know we can or can't do and become quite adamant about that. And then we will be good, healthy eaters when we do or we don't do that one thing. So maybe that's what happens at the dinner party.
All right. Let's go to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm interested in how we got educated to have a sweet tooth or a salt tooth in the first place. I think a lot of it has to do with microbiology and the fact that exosmosis will destroy bacteria when you have windjammers carting butter across the country and things like that. And some countries have a salt complex because of that, I think. And some countries have a sugar complex. So we've been taught to like sugar in an abnormal way. Could you say something about that, that history?
Sure. I would love to read that book, the one that's going to explain to me the difference between savory cultures and sweet cultures. I think that, you know, sweet being the primary preservative certainly built the sweet tooth. And maybe that's one of the things about canned fruit, you know, that you have so much sugar in it in order to do the preservative function. And so you have to then canned fruit becomes something that should taste quite sweet to people. Artificial sweetener is on average 200 to 300 times sweeter per part than sugar. So it's also should give us a little bit of a pause to just think about what kind of impact that has on our collective sweet tooth. If, in fact, we make the shift to diet drinks and diet products using things like aspartame or sucralose, we are avoiding calories, yes. We are not avoiding sweetness. In fact, we're enhancing sweetness, that there's such an intense sweet, right, that comes in that dosage that it then has an impact on the way other things must taste to us as well. So, in fact, yeah, I I'm not a scientist, and I don't want to go too far with it. But there is research now showing that our artificial sweetener consumption leads to enhanced carbohydrate consumption post dosing, right? So that you then go to carbs, and so when one thinks about the enhanced sweet tooth and that effect of the sweet but without calories then has an impact on the other kinds of things we eat as well, and may have an impact on the decline in salt and the taste for salt in American culture, or the taste for savory or bitter tastes, which food scientists and sensory scientists have charted.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Well, it seems that too, though, if you if you take a baby and you drop a little drop of something sweet on her tongue, she will smile. And if you drop something bitter, the baby is going to make that ugh face that says, ugh, I don't like that. And I suppose some people argue that the problem here, or one of the issues here, is we're working against a kind of taste preference that we are born with.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and so if there's a proclivity to sweet, right, in the human. And that's absolutely there. And no industrial food manufacturer needs to make that for us. It's part of the burden that we have in determining how to make our food choices and when we're full and what's sustainable for our bodies and what's sustainable for the environment. And the fact that sweetness becomes so much easier with every new innovation to add into our food, right? It's almost a bit like something out of the Matrix, where you can imagine yourself sort of hooked up to the sweet that always gets sweeter and sweeter and sweeter and ultimately has no calories. And after a while, you're just sort of floating in a sea of sweet. It is difficult to do without. It's difficult to eat the asparagus. You know, we know that. But we may need to do that sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Let's take, we want to make sure we get one more caller in here and the time that's left. And Champagne, line three. Hello.
Yes. Thank you. I haven't heard the entire broadcast, unfortunately, but I just wanted to make a comment and I guess ask a question in regards to this notion of the creation of needs, kind of historicizing you're obviously doing of how we perceive food in the post-war period and so on, though I obviously haven't read your work as of yet. But I study Japan, actually, and I live in Japan quite a bit. And something that's interesting about the Japanese is that, now, I don't know Europe in the same way, but they can't imagine eating as sweet a food as Americans eat. And typically when they live in the States or live in the West, they're shocked by how sweet cakes are, cookies and so forth, and they just won't eat them generally because they just they certainly have not had this notion of finding this level of sweetness of sugar and of artificial sweeteners in the food that we have. There's and so the, I really wonder in this historicization with the States how really new this is. In within my family, for example, my mother has always been a tea person, and she always eats hot, drinks hot tea. We grew up drinking pop, and I really the introduction of soda pop, especially in the 50s and 60s, which is extremely high, right, and fructose, that there was perhaps a kind of this, what I call at least a manufacturing or creation of needs by certain companies. And so I just wonder what you think about that. And secondly, something I've always heard, and I really know nothing about this, I'm quite ignorant of it actually, but I'd heard that from the 19, especially in the 70s and 80s onwards, that there were a lot of new artificial foods, such as the potato chips we all see with varying colors at the supermarket, and what was originally just the potato chip is now a classic potato chips, that one couldn't get a patent on living things as such. In other words, if you create a new food, of course, using living things and so on, but on a specific living thing, the notion that you couldn't get a patent on something meant that one would try to create, you know, no one can patent the potato, right? So yeah. Where, you could create all kinds of interesting and new kinds of...
Yeah, I need to, pardon me, because we're real short on time. I hate to interrupt you because they're both really interesting questions. We just don't have a lot of time for the guests to
I'll try to be really quick in answering because they're both really good points. One, there's a great level of diversity about sweet tastes, of course, across cultures. And you have rice cultures and savory cultures developing in very different ways from sweet ones. And anecdotally, yes, the U.S. does seem to be among the leading of the sweet cultures. And perhaps the globalization of foods and the increasing importation of foods and the tastes and the appreciation of different kinds of tastes will do something to kind of correct that excessive sweet within American tastes. And the other piece of this is, the patent system and the way that we deal with intellectual property, of course, has a piece to this. You know, you have develop an artificial sweetener, you have a corner on the market for a certain number of years. Then you don't. Then you need to develop a new one and a new one, the same way you have a proliferation of kinds of potato chips. You have a proliferation of kinds of sweets. There's nothing, there's no financial incentive to kind of re-aggregate the sweets or to say sugar. You know, well, who owns sugar? So, yes, that's certainly a big part of the way that the sweet taste and the sweet opportunities keep shifting just as we begin to kind of understand where we are.
There we'll have to stop. Our guest, Carolyn de la Peña, is Associate Professor of American Studies at UC Davis. She's here visiting the campus. She's going to give a talk that is part of an initiative sponsored in part by the Center for Advanced Study. This is a CAS initiative, Interpreting Technoscience, and she'll be talking about some about the history of artificial sweeteners this afternoon on the U of I campus at 4 in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. Otherwise, you can look for the book sometime next year, Empty Pleasures, An Unnatural History of Artificial Sweetener. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
WLIL programs are made possible by the Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffees, breakfast featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., and to-go sandwiches and salads for lunch. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall at the corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana. We are WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. We'll break here as we usually do so we can bring you an update on the markets and news. We'll be back. Please stay tuned.
Support for Illinois Public Media comes from Syngenta, featuring AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids, designed to give you up to 38 bushels more per acre if you have rootworms, and an average of 3 more even if you don't. More information on Syngenta's AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids is at agrisuretraits.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. Soybean futures, especially those nearbys, are showing some strength today as traders are covering short positions ahead of tomorrow's release of crop production and WASDE monthly reports from USDA. Front month September soybeans, which expires next week, has been up as much as 17.5 cents in a very light volume today. Deferred months not up quite as much, but still showing some positive gains. Meanwhile, as we look over in the corn pit, we're seeing that there is also some slight gains at this hour. Really no more than what we saw earlier off of the opening bell, but at least holding where it is at the moment. Let's look at some particulars in Kansas City. September wheat now, well, not trading. It never has opened. The December, though, trading at 473 and a quarter, up three quarters. March